Welcome back to the HBS podcast, where we discuss all things history, philosophy, and social studies of science. I am your host, Samara Greenwood, and today I have the pleasure of introducing you to Deakin Distinguished Professor and ARC Future Fellow, Professor Emma Cavall. Emma has a very richly textured intellectual and professional background, as you will hear in the episode today. She first trained as a medical doctor and public health researcher before turning to cultural and medical anthropology, and now she also works across science and technology studies as well as the history of science. To name just some of her countless achievements, Emma helped found both the highly successful Deakin Science and Society Network and the Australasian Science and Technology Studies Graduate Network, affectionately dubbed AusSTS. She's also the immediate past president of 4S, the International Society for Social Studies of Science. Emma's research centres on the intersection of indigeneity, colonial and post-colonialism, and genomics, bioethics, and public health. Today, our conversation focuses on her recently published monograph, Haunting Biology, Science and Indigeneity in Australia, in which Emma wrestles with the ghosts of science past that continue to have a presence in current-day Indigenous genomics, an emerging field in which Emma has been deeply involved for over a decade. Welcome to the podcast, Emma. It's so great to have you on.
Thanks, Sam. It's good to be here.
Now, you have a very interesting intellectual background and academic identity, so I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about this background and how you came to be connected to both science and technology studies as well as history of science.
The trajectory is basically I didn't have a plan. I just have kind of stumbled through doing things that seemed interesting at the time. I started actually right here at University of Melbourne, where we are recording. I was here as a 17-year-old medical student, fresh out of school, because I was a smart girl, so do medicine. That's as much thinking as I had done into it. My English literature teacher from school cried. She was very sad that I was going to do medicine. And I did find that it was very didactic and actually picked up English literature subjects when I was doing second year medicine and then ended up doing a combined degree, even though a combined degree didn't really exist. That's another theme, is I've just asked to do things that maybe weren't on the menu, but make them happen because they seem to be an interesting thing to do. And I actually did a history major in my arts degree, really just because I was choosing the subjects that seemed the most interesting at the time. When I was going to do honours, I was going to do it in medical history, but I kind of got diverted to medical anthropology in Papua New Guinea, which was wonderful, with Martha McIntyre. Mm. And then I came back and finished medicine. I was also very much an activist, eventually focusing on Indigenous solidarity activism. I went off to be a doctor in the Northern Territory, very explicitly wanting to work in Aboriginal health, and kind of quickly wanted to work in public health and then public health research. And actually, as I describe in my first monograph called Trapped in the Gap, Doing Good in Indigenous Australia, I was on a kind of trajectory to do the most good. And then I wrote a book about trying to understand that impulse and its kind of political implications. So, yeah, I was working in Indigenous public health across the Northern Territory, different communities, and then started a PhD and thought, what am I going to do for my PhD? And I had a like waking up at 2 a.m. moment and going, oh, I'll do a ethnography of this place where I'm at, all of these non-Indigenous white anti-racist people, the term I ended up using was white anti-racist, who are trying to help Indigenous people to address disadvantage but not impose their beliefs on Indigenous people. Indigenous people need to be doing it themselves. And I thought, this is very interesting and complicated. So that became my kind of ethnographic problem to try and sort out and develop an analysis of. So that was my first book. Eventually, after many years and iterations, I spent a year in the US during my PhD as a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And I was basically pretending to be a grad student there, which was super fun and interesting and socializing into the elite US grad scene. At that time, I was going across UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco, which has really great medical anthropology. And at that time, the first so-called ethnic drug was about to be released, Bidol, which was a drug that lowered blood pressure. And it was firstly patented and then licensed for African Americans. It was eventually released in 2005, this drug, and it set all the social scientists in a spin because we all believed there was no such thing as race. And suddenly there was this drug that was for African Americans. So I saw then that this question of biological difference was not going away. And I thought it'd be really interesting to see how it unfolded in Indigenous Australia. So that led many years later to this book that's just out. But to answer your actual question in terms of STS and history of science, yeah, I just became drawn to it. Yeah, I remember when I was in Darwin, I was giving talks to my colleagues about Leviathan and the air pump and explaining about why the history of science was so important for understanding how we see the world and definitely how we do science and Indigenous public health in that case. I actually applied to do my first postdoc with Helen Verrin here at Melbourne Uni, ended up being in anthropology. So I've kind of moved between STS, anthropology, HPS, and history of science has just always been a real passion of mine. I cannot claim to be a historian, but for this recent book, it's quite historical, I think.
That is a fascinating story. So you were very much led by subject matter, it sounds like, as opposed to a professional identity of sorts, that you weren't in one particular discipline. It was a variety of disciplines. Would that be true?
Yes. I have had a few different sliding doors moments where, like, at one point I was going to do public health physician training, which would have probably meant I ended up being in a medical faculty rather than an arts faculty. But yeah, that didn't happen. And I think because I'm a doctor and I did practice for 7 years, most of that part-time while I was doing my PhD, I suppose I think because I've always got that to fall back on, I maybe have felt more freedom than other people to just do what I thought. Yeah. And also I was just used to being a poor student as well. So.
Didn't have high expectations of income. Oh, that is really such a fascinating trajectory. And not even trajectory, is it? It's like a negotiation through a really interesting pathway. Thank you. But today we will be talking about your recently published book, Haunting Biology, Science and Indigeneity in Australia. I really enjoyed how you structured the book. It's not a straightforward history or critique of racial science, but rather a wonderfully layered account. So I was wondering if you could first tell us how you came to write the book in the particular way that you did.
Well, it was 8 years between conception and publication, and it was actually extended because of COVID for me. That was like 2 years in the house with my two teenage children, and that was very bad. Let's not go there. Don't talk about COVID. But even without that, it really does take a while to percolate your ideas and to try them out, giving different talks here and there. So I conceived of it while I was visiting at Yale in the History of Science department there with my colleague Joanna Raiden, who I've had written a fair bit with. I wanted to understand Indigenous genomics, which is this field that I had kind of found myself in and actually found myself part of forming. Through my ethnographic work, I gave that origin story of the first ethnic drug in the US and then thinking, how is this going to unfold in Indigenous Australia? So really from 2006, I've been following it from a time where there was almost no genetic research happening in Australia in Indigenous contexts. And the whole idea of doing genetic research with Indigenous people just seemed like very cringy. And I kind of talk about that specifically in one chapter about this kind of reaction of disgust of like, oh, that is not sound like a good idea. And this is because of the specific Australian history of assimilation and of stolen generations and of a plethora of legislation that was determining what Indigenous people could do, where they could live, who they could marry, where they could work based on the assigned caste, in inverted commas, that was ascribed by government officials. So with all of that history and the idea of pan-Indigeneity, which is that all Indigenous people in Australia are equally Indigenous, there's no kind of hierarchy of whether you look a certain way or live a certain way that makes you more Indigenous than others. And this has been really important since the 70s, definitely in Australia. So for all of those reasons, the idea of Indigenous genomics or Indigenous genetics just seemed kind of implausible. And so something that I was really interested in seeing how it happened. And it has. It's a thing.
So you like to dig into complexity, don't you? Not just complex, but like politically charged, difficult. Is there something that draws you in?
Yeah, that's right. I like a challenge. And when the answer is really obvious, like things that are really bad in the world, as an activist, I've always been very drawn to saying things about them and going to rallies. But as a scholar, I find them really uninteresting because it's really obvious what the answer is. But it's when things are, yeah, not so obvious. So on my whole project, it was about, well, let's look at people who are trying to do the right thing. Like, honestly, they have the right intentions, they have the tools, they have the resources, and what then? What happens then? So that's kind of been my more interesting set of questions for me.
There are also these layers of meaning evident in your book. So I was interested in what you would say are the central ideas you hoped a reader would take away with them.
It is complex. It is like a kind of set of experiences and set of instincts about a really complex and historically weighted area of study, studying Indigenous genomics, the biological differences that Indigenous people, you know, may or may not have, contain. The book is my wrestling with this question and my wrestling with the area of Indigenous genomics, which it turns out is a whole important field now of science. And it has a lot of resources. We have the very first professor of Indigenous genomics in the world is in Australia. So it's turned out that Australia is actually leading the world in some ways in this field. But what is the history of trying to understand groups biologically, particularly colonized minority groups, and how can we make biological difference about Indigenous people in the light of everything that's come before? Not to say that we shouldn't do it or that we should do it, but how does the past haunt what we are doing now?
Oh, excellent. This was captured well in one of the reviews of your book, which discussed how you showed that the messy history of biological difference is not a history left behind, but one that lingers and, as you say, haunts our current day shiny laboratory science. Could you tell us more about those specific complexities of thinking through indigeneity, human difference, and biology?
One way I've thought about this is that ethics, research ethics, has very much been in the past focused about protecting Indigenous people. Researchers who want to work with Indigenous people have to really make it clear what Indigenous people might benefit, how they might benefit from it, and what the risks are to them and whether those risks are justified. Increasingly, Indigenous people have to be very engaged and now pretty much always leading those kind of research efforts. So on the one hand, we've wanted to protect Indigenous people from research, and genetics and genomics has definitely been seen as too dangerous. So through my anthropological engagements over the last kind of 15 years, there have been many times where a project has got funding and might include genetics in some way, and then the genetics part is then not passed by the ethics committee, so it has to be removed. And this has happened again and again. But now things have very much changed, and the overriding idea in Indigenous genomics has been more around inclusion. That kind of narrative is that Indigenous people shouldn't miss out on the potential benefits of genomics, whether that is relating to health, relating to being able to provenance, unprovenanced human remains, which is a whole other, you know, very sensitive and controversial, but also very important issue. Finding relatives for those who have experienced stolen generations. All of these different potential uses for genetics are now seen as something that Indigenous people should have access to. Another way to put it is they shouldn't have to choose between engaging with science that might be dangerous to them and missing out on these potential benefits. They should be able to access the benefits of genomics on their own terms. So it's been super interesting to me to see this inclusion approach emerge.
To introduce the next part of the interview, I want to begin by reading a part of the first chapter of Haunting Biology. Now, I've edited it slightly, and I also will substitute Emma's name for when she refers to I as herself.
Drawing on both famous and obscure episodes in the history of scientific research on Indigenous bodies and populations, this book tells a larger story of how and why biological knowledge about Indigenous Australians was produced. Through these stories, Emma addresses questions that have relevance in all diverse societies. How are we to understand Indigenous biological difference in the 21st century? Is it a racist ruse, a stubborn residue of racial pseudoscience? Is it something that exists but that should not be allowed to have social or political relevance? Or is it a potentially empowering force that can be unlocked by newly accurate science or by being under Indigenous control? This book refuses to distinguish between good and bad biological knowledge, aiming neither to dismiss all biological knowledge as racist, nor to excuse any of its negative effects on Indigenous people. Instead, Emma argues that biological data, as different as diabetes incidence and hair form, contain persistent ghostly presences.
Perhaps you could tell us about one or two of those stories that you find particularly compelling and you think a listener would be interested in.
The book has got the word haunting in the title, and I do actually talk about haunting, both the kind of theories of haunting, which academics and theorists and I think just general people will find interesting, including how haunting and ghosts are really central to Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous experiences kind of around the country. But I actually talk about some ghosts, real ghosts. I don't know if that makes even sense as a phrase, but real ghosts. So one of the stories opens with a story of a Aboriginal poet. Her name's Romaine Morton. She was doing a research fellowship at the National Film and Sound Archive in Canberra. And she went there to look at Indigenous cultural and intellectual property in relation to ethnographic film that was held there. She realised once she'd started that actually this building used to be the Australian Institute for Anatomy, and it was built in the 1920s by a guy called Colin McKenzie, who had amassed a huge collection. He was really into marsupials and monotremes. He was an orthopaedic surgeon, as many of these collectors were. Well, not particularly orthopaedic surgeons, but, you know, the medical collectors and anthropologists often were kind of mixed up together in the late 19th, early 20th century. So he had this enormous collection which included Indigenous human remains. And in the 20s, he convinced the government that this was a really important collection, and they funded this Institute for Anatomy, which is one of the really earliest buildings in Canberra. So she realised that this building had housed Aboriginal human remains and had displayed them as well until the 1980s, where then it got handed over to become the National Film and Sound Archive. She was also staying at Colin McKenzie's private residence, which was next door. And one night she was haunted. She kind of experienced it, as she tells it, something like a dream where Colin McKenzie approached her holding a scalpel and he sliced the scalpel through her body. I came across this story in Warwick Thornton's film called The Dark Side, and I immediately was like, wow. I'd already been researching a set of interlacing histories, which is the history of the Institute for Anatomy and Colin McKenzie. It's also the history of the Australian Institute for Aboriginal Studies, what is now AATSIS, and that started in the 60s. And I'm particularly interested in the role of human biology in that. So when that started in the 1960s, it had four committees. One was linguistics, one was prehistory, which later on got called archaeology, one was social anthropology, and one was human biology. That surprised me. Like, oh, there was a human biology committee. That was actually around till 1987. And that connected very much to the history of blood samples that were collected at the ANU through the 60s and 70s, and which I'd been involved in since 2010 and became the National Centre for Indigenous Genomics, which is the first Indigenous-governed genome facility in the world. So this haunting wove together these histories of bone, blood samples, race, indigeneity, and Indigenous studies, and really what it means to make biological knowledge about Indigenous people.
Another complexity you raise in the book is current science, as you've mentioned, that involves Indigenous scientists engaged in studying biological difference. Could you tell us a bit more about the current status of this, the challenges and the potential of this line of research?
Yeah. So one of the important things I've done alongside being involved with the National Centre for Indigenous Genomics, which is, as I said, this Indigenous governed genome facility that I was quite involved with setting up, but I haven't been involved in that for a few years, and it's been just amazing to see, you know, going from strength to strength. What I've also been involved with is called SING, which stands for Summer Internship for Indigenous People in Genomics, which is a program that started in the US in 2011 and is now spread in other countries, which is workshops for Indigenous people to learn about genomics, to actually, you know, extract DNA. And I had my fun time in the lab and learned that science is just like cooking. So that was very enlightening, but also to learn about all the ethical issues and political and cultural issues related to genomics. So that's been really successful. We've done it in Australia since, I think it was 2018, and now it's run completely by Indigenous people. And there is this growing group of Indigenous geneticists and other scientists and academics with expertise. So this is, in many ways, like the end point of what one would hope for, the logic of what I came into as a young doctor and a young researcher and young activist, that Indigenous people need to be in charge of everything, like whatever activity is relevant to them, to their communities, and then that will solve many of the problems. So that's something that I've really personally believed in and tried to contribute to. But I also will always have questions about it, because that's what I do, is I question things. So part of the arguments running through the book is to question how Indigenous scientists might be also haunted by these histories and these pasts. You know, it's a question that we can't answer yet, because Indigenous genomic science is quite new. But I suppose I'm putting those questions out there for those Indigenous scientists to think about and maybe write their own books about it in the future.
Slightly off topic, but it is reminiscent of feminist philosophers of science, where there's that question of we're working within science, we're trying to make science itself, you know, more gender aware and gender inclusive. But there's always that tension of working within the framework that's already being produced that has this historical background that has excluded. How do you do that? How do you navigate those tensions? Because you are haunted always by those origin stories and the things that are still contain those biases.
I think about that in the book in terms of different positions towards ghosts. So for many scholars, the idea of Indigenous genomics is still very cringy. It's like, well, we can't have that. It's been too dangerous. There's been too many things that have gone wrong. The low point in that modern discourse was the Human Genome Diversity Project in the 1990s, which was called the Vampire Project and led to worldwide opposition from Indigenous people. So a dangerous kind of science. And that shift now to saying, no, it can be something that can benefit us, to not want to engage with genomics at all is to reject the ghosts, but to just take up the science unproblematically or unthinkingly is to like ignore the ghosts. So what I'm trying to say in the book is that we need to live with the ghosts, to acknowledge their existence and to find a way to live with them.
So just two final questions. Many in our audience are practicing scientists. So what do you think they might take away from your book?
Well, hopefully a love of history and a appreciation for thinking about who's come before them, to think the questions that they're asking have previous iterations, and in their quests to do something useful and to be of benefit to society, there's also those previous iterations of people that were trying to also do things that benefited society. And if we don't understand history, we will repeat it. I suppose that old adage is a good way to summarise it.
What about a broader audience? What might we all take away from your research on science and indigeneity in Australia?
Well, I think that the questions that I'm asking are fundamental questions about justice in a settler colony, in a place where colonisers have come and migrants have come and there's been a population that has been dispossessed, and that we are now trying to counter that by supporting Indigenous people, supporting Indigenous scholars. But what is the history that we have to face if any of this is actually going to be helpful in the long term?
Definitely. Thank you so much for that, Emma. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast and having this wonderful discussion. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing about all of the aspects of your work. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you for listening to Season 3 of the HBS podcast. If you are interested in the detail of today's conversation, you can access the transcript on our website at hbsunimelb.org. Stay connected with us on social media, including Blue Sky, for updates, extras, and further discussion. We would like to thank the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne for their ongoing support. And thank you for joining us in the wonderful world of HBS. We look forward to having you back again next time.